You have to take a good breath after that. No. Bert, it's good to see you. It's encouraging to see you here. Brother Bert's been taking cancer treatments for a long time now. I'm glad to see you're able to be out. Also, our brother Tyrone still has another week in South Sudan. So let's pray for his continued safety and safe return home. I don't think there was an announcement made, but somewhere near the end of our assembly, if you have, today is our quarterly contribution day for the blue envelope, so just hang on to them and we'll have a special contribution for those before our assembly is over. And if you're visiting with us, please know that you're a special welcome guest, and you very well may not have known that we're going to have a dinner on the ground, we call it. It's not actually going to be on the ground, but after our second assembly. And while that may be a little bit inconvenient for those who are in the first assembly, then we hope that you'll make plans to come back and be a part of that meal today. Several years ago, I was blessed to be able to make a trip to Alaska, and I was preaching in Sitka, Alaska, at the community center there, and worked in a little bit of extra time so that I could do a little camping in a place where I had wanted to go my entire life. And while I was there, I met a young man in his 30s who had a beautiful family, wife and two children. And he found out that we were there, and he volunteered to take myself and a friend fishing in his family's incredible twin diesel cabin cruiser fishing boat. And he said, if you'll just help me pay for a little diesel, then I'll take you out. And the boat was only a year or so old. And while we were out enjoying the stunning surroundings and the fantastic fishing, we learned some more about this young man. His dad was an extremely successful businessman who owned a ranch in Texas. And he had one brother, who were just the two boys in the family. They were a very religious family, and one day his dad came home and announced to his wife and sons, I quit my job today. We're leaving, we're going to sell the ranch, and we're moving to Alaska. Well, it took a little while for his wife to be able to recover from that shock, but then he gave his family, set them down, and he gave them this explanation. He said, with the salary that I make, we don't feel dependent on God. And I don't want to raise you boys that way. And so he quit his job, sold his ranch, they moved to Alaska. It was 9 years later when I met this young man. His father had moved, and the family had moved to Alaska, and he owned a commercial fishing boat. And the boys had helped him with that. And 9 years later now, each one of the sons also owned a commercial trawler, and they had been blessed to pool their resources and purchase this boat that we were on as a family pleasure boat. And actually, there were a couple of groups of medical doctors who leased the boat for about 6 weeks each year, and that paid the note on their boat for them. So they were good business people all the way around. But I was in awe of a man who would give up what a job and a lifestyle that most would consider the envy of this world, because he was concerned that it interfered with his family's trust in God. And he's not the only one who's ever done that. In fact, I know a number of missionaries who have done similar things, either have given away their possessions or sold them to help finance their work. I remember discussing that kind of sacrifice with one of my daughters and son-in-law, Kyle and Leslie Klein, when they had committed to go to Brazil for 5 years. Kyle was working for an oil company, and we talked about it. And he said, I can remember among the things that he said, I'm going to miss hunting and fishing. But I believe that whatever I miss here, God is going to more than make up in heaven. And that thought stuck with me for the 5 years that they were there. And it's a privilege and an honor to help and to support people who have that kind of faith. The Lord's apostles were just that kind of people, weren't they? In Matthew chapter 4, it says that of Peter and Andrew that they left their nets and followed him. In that same context, it says of James and John that they left their boat and their father and followed Jesus. And then Luke chapter 5 of Matthew, he got up and left everything and followed him, the tax collector. While he was there on the job, Jesus came by and said, "Follow me." He said he got up and he left everything and he followed him. And when we go back into the Old Testament, God chose Abraham as the epitome of the lifestyle of those who would be faithful disciples. He became, the book of Hebrews said, the father of the faithful. Because when God called him, he left his family's homeland. And he took just the possessions that he could carry with him, and he spent the rest of his life in tents. Because the Bible testified that he was looking for a home that was not on this earth. He was looking for a home whose builder and maker was God. And consequently, he spent the rest of his life having given up what most of us would consider security to walk with God and let God lead him every day. And he trusted in God, and consequently, he is called the father of the faithful. We're ending a series of lessons that I've entitled How to Use Your Money, not a very catchy title, I will admit, but it's taken from the text of Luke chapter 16, verse 1 through 15, Jesus' story about the wasteful but shrewd steward, and we're wrapping that series up today. We've learned some things, hopefully, by now. One of them is that we're not owners of anything. We're just stewards. It's all God's. It belongs to Him. And the quicker we understand and admit that, the better our life is going to be as Christians. It's not ours. It belongs to God. Secondly, we've learned that God gives us, as stewardship, possessions as vehicles to help us prepare for eternity. He gave it. He has given us these things to see who we love. And gives us the opportunity to love either God or money. Because it's necessary that we make that decision if we're going to be disciples of Jesus. He knew that we needed help in developing into faithful stewards. And so he gave us a stewardship. Because if you will be faithful in a little, he will give you much. If you will be faithful in the riches of this world, ungodly mammon, he calls it, then you will be rewarded with true riches. And the Lord only knows what all is involved in that, and he doesn't tell quite yet, does he? But in comparison with little and much, and unrighteous mammon, and true riches, he uses these things to see who it is that we'll follow. And he knew that if we're faithful in little, then he can trust us with much. The rich fool wasn't a fool because he prepared for retirement. But he was, in fact, a fool because that's all he prepared for. Retirement on this earth. Jesus has taught us that we're to be neither wasteful with money nor to hoard it. On both ends of it, it's wrong. And then thirdly, we learned that we can't be a true disciple if we view money as our source of security rather than God. You cannot serve both God and money. You cannot trust both God and money. That's what he said in verses 13 through 15. And I have to tell you, after having preached these lessons, I don't particularly like preaching about money. And I think it probably has to do with a weakness on my part, maybe an overreaction to hearing people complain through much of my youth about saying that almost every time that a preacher preached on money, all that preacher preaches about is money. But Jesus liked to preach about money. Or if he didn't like to, at least he did a great deal of it. An incredible amount of it. And that's interesting because he didn't need money. You realize that, right? He didn't need money. He could get money out of a fish's mouth. He could get a 2-drachma coin. And I strongly suspect that had he wanted to, that coin could have been a gold coin. And had he needed it, he could have had a whole school of fish just lining up, waiting to cough up a coin, each one of them, until he had how much? Where would his power have ended? How much money could he have collected from the fish bringing money to Peter that day? No end to it, could he not? He didn't need money. And he was teaching his disciples about that, that God will provide. There was a lot more where that coin came from, and I think his disciples recognized that. Furthermore, and this is kind of scary sometimes for me to say, for leaders in the church to hear me say, God still doesn't need money. God doesn't need your money. He doesn't need my money. He's going to do perfectly well without it. If you choose to keep it and not give it. But you won't. Because he knows that you need to be generous with what he's given you. He knows that you need to give it. Generosity and sacrifice are a vital part of developing faith. It helps you get your heart right and keep your priorities straight. And just hearing about it one time in life is not enough. Jesus taught about it over and over. And while we're right there, I haven't talked about giving money to the church in this series. That's not my motivation for this series of lessons. My motivation is to teach you and me and to remind us of the principle that God wants us to use to live as faithful stewards, so that when we come to the end of our lives, we will be able to hear him say, "Well done, good, faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I'm going to make you ruler over many things." And only when and if we accept these priorities, these principles that God has given to us, will that happen in our life. But our giving, as a little mini sermon right here, to the Lord, is to be cheerfully. And if you can't do it cheerfully, then keep it. If you don't want to give it, don't give it. God doesn't need it. You need to give it, but God doesn't need it. So it's to be done cheerfully. It is to be done in proportion to God's blessings. So if God hasn't blessed you very much, then he doesn't require very much. If he has blessed you greatly, then he expects you to give in accordance with what he's given to you. And then thirdly, our giving is to be done as a means of expressing our gratitude to God. And we talk about sometimes, and this is a little one of those little peeves that I have a little bit. Sometimes we talk about, "Lord, help us to give back a little bit of what you've given us." Here's what we should be saying. God, it's all yours. It's all yours. And I'm only going to keep what I feel like I really need. It's all yours. I don't want to give back a little bit. I want to give it all back to him. Don't you? Everything that we have. He knows it. I need to know it. It's all his. And when I surrender it all back to him, then we're putting the pieces of our life together so that we can be the kind of disciples that God wants us to be. Let me just listen. Let's listen together of a few of the teachings just in Luke's gospel and just in a section of it to be impressed with how much he talks about it. In Luke 6:35, love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great and you'll be sons of the Most High. That's Luke chapter 6. In Luke chapter 7, he tells the story of a sinful woman who broke an expensive bottle of perfume and poured it on his feet. And both his disciples and the Pharisees criticized her when they saw her do it. Now, I got a question for you. Do you think she cares about that criticism today? They tried to humiliate her. They tried to make her look like a foolish, wasteful person. You could have used that. She could have used that and sold it and given to the poor. You think she cares one whit about that criticism today? I think not. I think she probably today is gladder that she did that one thing than anything else she did in her life. And yet she got criticized for it because it seemed like it was something really foolish at the time to everybody around her. Jesus used that incident to teach that it's only natural for someone who has been forgiven great things to express our gratitude in elaborate, extravagant ways. Have you been forgiven? Little or much? How you answer that has a lot to do with your attitude about how you use the things that God's entrusted to you. And then in the next chapter, Luke chapter 8, he tells the parable of the sower, one of the most prominent parables and famous parables that he ever told. And included among the different four types of soils that the seed fell on, some seeds failed to produce because those of whom it represented allowed, quote, this life's worries, riches, and pleasures to choke them and keep them from maturing. You think you might know some folks who allow the worries of life to keep us from using our money in such a way that we lay up treasures for heaven? We worry about what might, what if, what if, what if, what if, and we just keep piling it up in view of that. You think you might know some folks who allow the fact that we have lots of riches to get concerned about somebody's going to find a way to get this away from me, and we just keep trying to pile it up? You think you might know somebody who would fall into the category of because of the amount of pleasure that I can use money to gain in my life, we just keep using it on ourselves? That's what that story was about. About folks who allowed these things, worries, riches, and the pleasures of life, to choke the spiritual life out of us. Because God has blessed us, it keeps us from maturing. And those people will die having never done anything of any real value in their life. And they'll lose everything that they work for. And then in the next chapter, Luke chapter 9, Jesus sent out his 12 disciples in pairs to preach the gospel and to heal. And he gave them these instructions. Take nothing with you for the journey. No staff, no bag, no bread, no money, no clothes. Don't take anything with you. And you go. What do you think he was trying to teach them? I'm going to take care of you. What do you think he wanted us to gain from that story? I will take care of you. He also fed a crowd of over 5,000 in that same chapter with 5 loaves and 2 fish so that we would know he can supply our needs any way he chooses. It doesn't have to be from some way that we expect it to be. It doesn't have to be because he increases our financial base or our salary to the point that I can see that I can take care of myself for the rest of my life. If we trust him, even in circumstances when it looks like, well, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. I don't know how it's possibly going to work. Has God ever failed to come through for you? Has he ever failed to come through for you? Why don't we learn? Why do we have to keep falling back whenever he's trying to teach us to trust him? And then in the next chapter, Luke chapter 10, he sent out the 72 disciples to towns that he was about to visit, and he told them, do not take a purse or bag or sandals. And the parable of the Good Samaritan teaches us that loving God and loving your neighbor requires us to be eager to do good for those who have less than we do. Those who are unfortunate in this life. And we don't have time to consider the parable of the rich, foolish farmer. And think about the lesson. Fool, the tonight your life has required of you. Then whose will these things be? Are the teaching about God's care of the birds and the flowers? Are the story of the wasteful, the prodigal son, and the materialistic older son? Are the rich man and Lazarus? Are the poor widow and her two pennies? Are Zacchaeus, who when he came down out of the tree and was accepted by Jesus out of gratitude, said, I give half of my wealth to the poor this very day. Are the rich young ruler who loved his money and went away sorrowfully? Are the parable of the 10 servants who each received minas to give an account for when the master came back? Are the instructions regarding paying government taxes? Numerous other teachings and parables that Jesus gave. And right in the middle of all of this teaching, there was a woman who was so impressed with Jesus that she blurted out from the crowd, blessed is the mother who gave you birth and nursed you. And Jesus responded, rather, blessed are those who hear the word of God and obey it. Jesus knew full well that not everybody was going to respond positively to his teachings. In Matthew chapter 11 and 12, those two chapters put together a series of incidences that demonstrate that some received the teaching of Jesus with doubt, some with criticism, some with indifference, some with blasphemy, and some just outright rejected. And he knows that there are going to be those who receive it. In fact, the majority of people are going to receive the teachings of Jesus, whether it's about how you use your money or anything else in your life, in those ways. But he's looking for the Zacchaeuses, who, when given the opportunity and when they understood the message, responded with joy. I've preached 8 lessons on the Lord's teaching about how to use your money from this story that Jesus told. And one of the fundamentals of Christianity is it not enough to hear it, it's not enough to hear it and understand it and acknowledge it and agree with it. We must put it into practice in our life. It's not enough to just to hear these teachings of Jesus and agree with them. But we put it into practice. And if we don't do it, we're deceiving ourselves, James chapter 1, verse 22 says. And I guess of all the ways that a person can be deceived, the most treacherous is to deceive yourself, isn't it? It'd be hard to ever overcome that, wouldn't it? To justify yourself for whatever you're doing and thus deceive yourself. He continues by saying, if a man listens to it and keeps on doing what I commanded, he'll be blessed in what he does. So I'm going to propose something to you and to myself in response to Jesus' teaching. Don't be like the little boy whose mama gave him 2 nickels and told him one is for you and the other one is for God to put in the collection plate on the next Sunday, and he lost one of the nickels. And guess whose nickel he decided he lost? Some of us are kind of like that. We go on a trip, we come back, we miss a Sunday, we don't make up our contribution. We lost a nickel, and it was God's. Or we used it some other way. And I'm going to suggest that you as an individual and as a family take the time and make the opportunity to take advantage of an opportunity to give sacrificially. To do it deliberately. If you have children at home, sit down with them and talk to them about it. And find an incident. Find some way. Find a need that you will fill, and you will do so by giving something up. And I promise you. Now, I can't promise you if your children are 2 years old, but if they're 7 or 8 years old or older, they'll never forget it. They'll remember that. And the greater sacrifice you make, the more it will impact their lives. I have memories like that in my life. My children have memories like that in their life. You don't lose those things. It changes your life. When you see your mom and your dad give sacrificially, and you know that it costs cost them. You know that there were some things that they wanted that they decided, at least for a while, to do without because they were going to meet this need. Remember, Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, you must deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow me. We have some folks who are generous on all occasions. And that's what Jesus said he wanted his disciples to be. And they're a blessing to everyone. And God is proud of such disciples. The Lord will reward such folks many, many fold. And so my encouragement at the end of this series of lessons is listen to Jesus. Follow the examples of those who've gone before us, who've sacrificially, joyfully given of themselves to the Lord so that the gospel could be spread and so that God could be glorified. While we stand in